an anti-colonialist Viet movement opposed to the colonial order the French wanted to build upon it. Viet royalist elites not only fled abroad to Japan, China, and Thailand, but many also headed into the nearby Central Highlands. This was the case for the Nguyen court scholars turned patriots Phan Dinh Phung, Thong That Thuyet, and the boy emperor Ham Ni, whom they smuggled out of Wei when the French sacked the imperial capital in 1885. In order to contain the emergence of Vietnamese anti-colonialism in the highlands, the French immediately adopted policies to turn the non-Viet peoples against their former overlords and to align them with themselves. This meant replacing Viet imperial administrators in the highlands with French commissioners and a new generation of Highlander military and administrative elites. It also meant protecting Highlander peoples and cultures from ethnic Viet immigration, although that never worked out so nicely in practice. But French imperial strategies also created new Highlander identities, territorial spaces, and inter-ethnic oppositions that had never existed before, but which continue to shape modern Vietnam to this day. The first Frenchmen to administer people in the Central Highlands were not colonial officials. They were, in fact, European Catholic missionaries seeking shelter from Minh Mang's persecution. Pushed out of the lowlands, these religious men immediately focused on civilizing and converting the highland peoples to Christianity. As one French priest wrote in 1830s, "One would have to make men of them first in order to make Christians of them." While large-scale conversions of the highlanders came later, these missionaries spread Christianity into the highlands for the first time, and in so doing introduced new religious practices, identities, and rituals that mixed with pre-existing beliefs and added to the mosaic discussed before and elsewhere in this book. Missions emerged with their own territorial boundaries, while priests provided another layer of ethnographic knowledge about the non-Viet peoples. The French conquest of Vietnam certainly provided safety for the missionaries and facilitated their work in the highlands. In exchange, military officers and administrators looked to the missionaries to provide them with the information and the help they badly needed to rule in these far-flung areas into which Viet royalists were regrouping and the British, Thais, and Germans were thought to be active. Colonial rulers were so desperate in the early years for administrative help that they even turned to a fast-talking megalomaniac adventurer named Marie-Charles David de Mairena. In 1885, as the anti-colonialist Can Vuong or Save the King movement took off, de Mairena and a handful of priests jointly organized a confederation of non-Viet peoples in the central highlands of Kontum. The problem, however, was a familiar one: ensuring loyalty. In 1888, French officials were aghast when they learned that instead of remaining as one part of the Confederation, de Mairena had decided instead to create his own new separate kingdom of the Sedang. Its name referred to one of the tribal groups in Kontum. For de Mairena, his new kingdom was a sovereign, independent state, complete with its own stamps, flag, and customs service. He even declared himself king and made Catholicism his state's official religion. While colonial authorities quickly ended this most embarrassing experiment in indirect rule, clearly they had been conned, de Mairena's kingdom, like Nung Tri Khao's before it and others elsewhere, reminded all of the need to take control of the highlands before others did. This fiasco also convinced many French Republican officials that they could not trust missionaries. One went so far as to write that the de Mairena affair showed that French priests wanted to create a free state like that of the Jesuits in Paraguay. Republicans truly feared this, as mad as Mairena was. For the time being, the French depended most on their military and its officers to rule, as diplomats cobbled together what, by the early 1900s, became known as French Indochina. Like the Nguyen before them, French administrators created military territories in the northern highlands and Laos. They also transferred highland territories and borders back and forth between Cochin China, Annam, Tonkin, Laos, and Cambodia, searching for the best ways to rule over those whom some had started to call the Moi peoples, Of Sino-Vietnamese origin, this term referred to peoples who did not share in the East Asian cultural world discussed before. They were the uncivilized, the barbarians. In French hands, however, Moy became a handy word to refer to the non-Viet Central Highlanders in Annam in particular, the Montagnards, later on, for those who dwelled in the entire massif. In 1931, the Central Highlands, covering parts of northern Cochin China and Annam, counted 600,000 Moys. Further to the north, in the Tonkin Highlands, another 700,000 ethnic minorities, minority ethnique, resided, To, Thai, Man, Hmong, Nung, Lolo, and so on. To this tally, the French added 312,000 Khmer in the Mekong Delta. In all, a population of about 1.7 million non-Viet peoples lived in the highlands of the Annamese Cordillera, which ran into the Mekong marshlands. With the arrival of Paul Doumerc and the death of Phan Dinh Phung at the turn of the century, the French focused further on consolidating their control over the highlands. True to style, Doumerc created new highland provinces for Pliku, Darlac, and Aut Thonai. Others soon followed. Impressed by what the Nguyen had created, one subordinate reported that it was important to embrace a system of direct rule for the Central Highlands. I will not hide from you that this seems more practical to manage a people as primitive as the Moy. By direct rule, however, colonial authorities did not mean assimilation. Even though Annam was a French protectorate and the French should therefore have been maintaining the pre-existing Nguyen administration and mandarins to rule all of Annam indirectly, including non-Viet areas, this was not desirable in the Annamese highlands because the French did not trust their monarchs or their mandarins there. The French decided instead to withdraw most Viet administrators from the Central Highlands and rule themselves through French commissioners who, in turn, would collaborate with the local headmen like the Gerai leader, Kunjanab in Darlac province, and Deo Van Tri in the northwestern highlands. Unlike in Laos and Cambodia, where the French relied on ethnic Viet bureaucrats to help them rule, the French largely excluded the Viet from the highland administration. At the same time, French colonialism triggered changes that ran counter to that very isolationist policy. Firstly, they expanded the number of roads crisscrossing Indochina in unprecedented ways. Secondly, French financial groups, investors, and the Bank of Indochina, keen to open more mines and plantations, promoted the economic development of highland areas after the First World War. Rubber, coffee, and tea could grow well in different parts of the entire Vietnamese massif. Thirdly, thanks to better roads, technology, and modern finance, more settlers and companies moved into the area to stake land claims, establish plantations, and blast open new mines. This, in turn, stimulated an unprecedented demand for labor. And when highland peoples balked at joining this new commercial world, settlers never hesitated to bring in ethnic Viet labor instead, or to resort to imposing the corvée upon the non-Viet. Viet entrepreneurs also wanted to open up the highlands for similar reasons. Little wonder the patterns of Viet colonialism started to move westward under the French. In 1943, 42,000 ethnic Viet and 5,100 French people resided in the highlands. Although minuscule compared to the larger Central Highlander population of 1 million by the Second World War, these Euro-Viet colonialists were the start of an ever larger influx of workers and settlers. Some Viet plantation owners even had an edge over their French counterparts. But such Franco-Vietnamese intrusions into the highlands often triggered violent resistance from the indigenous populations. This commercial penetration of the highlands led to another affair that would do much to seal an alliance between colonial officials and highlander elites and stimulate the birth of a separate Moy identity. The man at the center of this affair was Leopold Sabatier. Between 1913 and 1926, this professionally trained administrator worked tirelessly from his office in Ban Mae Thuat, tending to the Radi and other highlanders in Dak Lak province. Unlike de Marena, Sabatier's loyalty to the French colonial state was unshakable. particularly close to Pierre Pasquier, the commissioner of Annam after the First World War, Sabatier understood the importance of the Highlanders in the defense of Indochina and in containing Vietnamese nationalism. In 1916, another Vietnamese emperor, Doi Tan, had tried to escape the role of puppet monarch which the French had imposed upon him by heading for these same hills. Pasquier and Sabatier also wanted to protect the pristine Highlanders from the Franco-Viet settlers and the commercial economy they represented. Sabatier's originality resided in his efforts to bequeath the Highlanders a separate identity, but one which was allied with the French. With Pasquier's backing, he devised and published a Romanized Radi writing system, presided over the creation of a Radi customary law code and justice system, opened Franco-Radi schools for thousands of youngsters, recruited men into the French-led colonial army, opened hospitals, and introduced modern medicine. He personally participated in the Highland Oath ceremonies, during which he publicly professed his government's unflinching respect for the Highlanders in exchange for their recognition of French sovereignty. Similar efforts were made among the Highlanders in the north, as well as among the Khmer in Cochinchina, whose children attended renovated pagoda schools under French, not Vietnamese, control. But Sabatier's efforts to isolate the Highlands landed him in trouble in the 1920s, when powerful people with financial interests called for his removal. Most importantly, Sabatier's tenure coincided with the upswing in the world demand for rubber. As prices soared, financial groups pressed the metropolitan and colonial authorities to open up the Highlands to further commercial development. Rubber trees grew well in the Terres Rouges of the Central Highlands. French and Viet landowners and settlers joined them in calling for Sabatier to be ousted. Despite Pasquier's efforts to protect his loyal servant, these Franco-Viet groups finally succeeded in dislodging Sabatier from his post in 1926. Once again, the colonizers were not always one monolithic bloc, racially or economically. Here, French and Vietnamese settlers had joined forces. While Euro-Viet settlers may have mocked Sabatier for defending the Highlanders, esteem for him ran high within the colonial administration and army. Indeed, his work with Aradi served as the blueprint for subsequent administrators keen to contain Vietnamese nationalists and communists and to protect Indochina from external threats. In 1935, in the wake of massive lowland Viet revolts at Yen Bay and Nhi An a few years earlier, one French general argued strongly in favor of creating an autonomous Moi region under the Governor-General's guidance. Another emphasized the need to save this race, to disentangle it from all harmful foreign influences through a direct administration, and to tie these tribes to us. These proud peoples, with their spirit of independence, will provide us with elite troops, serve as safety valves in case of internal insurgency, and act as powerful combat units in case of external war. In the late 1930s, Governor-General Jules Brevier insisted that the Moi constituted a unique racial group and as such deserved the creation of separate French territorial administration. In 1939, as the Japanese army moved its troops down the southern China coast, Brevier created the General Inspectorate for the Moi region. And while French-controlled Vietnam was under Japanese occupation, Vichy's Governor-General Jean de Caux solemnly participated in the oath ceremony and tried to transfer the colonial capital to Dalat. Though never officially considered as such, the Highland areas constituted collectively a separate French protectorate, one part in the central highlands of Annam, the other concentrated in northwestern Tonkin. Speaking of the Central Highlands in 1937, a French administrator insisted that there is more to Indochina than Laos, Cambodia, Tonkin, Annam, and Cochinchina. One must, to be entirely accurate, complete this geographical expression of Indochina by adding to it a sixth part, that of the Pei Moi. And, as we shall find out, from this sixth part, a separate Highlander identity would emerge. Maintaining French control over the Highlands. As attractive as it was for budding Highlander nationalists and strongmen, French protectorate rule placed the people of the Massifs in a very dangerous position in 1945, when the Japanese overturned the French colonial state before capitulating to the Allies a few months later. Stepping into the vacuum, Vietnamese nationalists seized power. On the 2nd of September 1945, Ho Chi Minh declared the birth of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. This government immediately decreed laws unifying Tonkin, Annam, and Cochin China into one sovereign territory and turning the great majority of those born or residing within Vietnam's borders into Vietnamese citizens. This included the 2 million non-Viet people who were living in the highlands. Ho did not recognize French rule there or any other special colonial arrangements. It was, he insisted, simply Vietnamese. But the French were not about to relinquish their Indochinese colony or their direct administration of the highlands, not yet. Starting in Saigon in September 1945, they slowly retook their Indochinese colony piece by piece until they had triggered a full-scale war with the DRV in late 1946. The new High Commissioner of Indochina, Georges Thierry d'Argenlou, immediately renewed efforts to turn the central highlands and peoples against Vietnamese nationalists, relying on a veteran group of Indochinese administrators in order to do so. In May 1946, at the very moment he was piecing together the provisional government of the Republic of Cochin China, Thierry d'Argenlou also presided over the creation of the highland populations of southern Indochina, Populations Montagnardes du Sud Indochinoise. Administered by the French, this autonomous territorial domain consisted of the central highland provinces of Annam. Like his predecessors reaching back to the Nguyen, Thierry d'Argenlou traveled to Ban Me Thuat to take part in the oath ceremony. Democratic Republic of Vietnam officials protested vigorously, insisting that the highlands were Vietnamese, but to no avail. Significantly, the French were no more willing to cede the upland regions to the Vietnamese government, which they themselves sought to build in the form of the Associated State of Vietnam. Although Léon Pignon, the French High Commissioner between 1948 and 1950, had allowed for the unification of this Vietnam, his team intentionally attached the operation of the highlands to Bao Dai, convinced that they could control their emperor and, through him, the central massif, as they had done in the past. This is how and why the crown domain of the southern highlander country, Domaine de la Couronne du Pays Montagnard du Sud, came to life in 1950. By winning over Bao Dai's collaboration, the French had devised a method to continue to maintain a separate hold over this militarily important part of Indochina. Although the French nominally recognized Vietnamese sovereignty over the highlands, they maintained a special status for the highlands because of special French obligations. In 1950, immaculately dressed in white suits, Léon Pignon and Bao Dai stepped before 2,000 highland chiefs in Ban Me Thuat to participate in the oath ceremony. But everyone knew that France's longtime Indochina hand, Jean Cousteau, ran the highlands as the special delegate, not the Vietnamese monarch. The crown domain of the southern highlander country thus serves as a case study in Bao Dai's failure to force the French to decolonize completely, when he could have done so. The crown domain was nothing more than a new term for the continuation of the de facto French protectorate over the sixième pays of colonial Indochina. Until 1954, the French continued to support a separate territorial administration, highlander education, language training, and military service. In so doing, the French brought isolated highlanders together like never before. Hundreds of young men coming from across the central massif met each other in the classrooms of the newly opened Collège Sabatier. Many accepted administrative positions outside their native lands, and in so doing developed long-lasting and often unprecedented relationships extending across the hills. Similar things happened in Highlander combat units. Marriage across clan lines increased. French and, increasingly, Radi began to serve as a common language. Protestant missionaries, mainly American and French, started attracting thousands of converts in the highlands. Their schools and missions circulated Highlander youth across tribal lines, and from 1950 onward, the French and Americans promoted special agricultural and infrastructure programs for this area. The French extended these policies to the northern massif. Of particular concern was that the transfer of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam to the northern highlands from late 1946 onward would lead Ho Chi Minh's administrators to turn the large Thai, Hmong, and Nung populations there against the French. And of course, the DRV tried. In February 1946, the French moved troops from southern China, where they had fled the Japanese coup in Indochina in March 1945, into the Thai regions of northwestern Vietnam. With the outbreak of full-scale war later that year, French officials renewed their contacts with Thai clans. Foremost among them was Deo Van Tri, whose son Deo Van Long was now in charge. In 1948, in exchange for Thai loyalty and collaboration against the Democratic Republic of Vietnam administratively and militarily, the French granted the Northwest autonomous rule in the form of a Thai federation. Led by Deo Van Long, this federation regrouped the strategically important northwestern provinces of Lai Chau, Phong Tho, and Son La together. Here, too, the French promoted the Thai language, education, military training, and created a new generation of ethnic Thai civil servants. As they had done with the Central Highland Domain, the French connected the Thai Federation to the person of Bao Dai, albeit via French officials once more. Many Highlander elites, village headmen, and colonially trained civil servants and officers embraced the creation of a wider nationalist identity, which was separate from the one ethnic Viet leaders sought to impose. And at war over the destiny of Indochina, opposing Vietnamese states, the French, increasingly backed by the Americans, organized and militarized the massif as never before in its long history. Indeed, French and soon American military officers became heavily invested in working with Highland peoples, just as did their Vietnamese enemies. Nationalist strategies and Highlander autonomy. War mitigated any hard-handed assimilationist moves on the part of Vietnamese communists, at least during the early years of the Indochina conflict. In order to combat the French and their allies, experts in charge of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam's newly created Highlander Affairs Bureau carefully respected local traditions, languages, and cultures, and promised autonomy. While Ho's specialists might not have had either the professional training of someone like Leopold Sabatier, nor could they draw upon a pre-existing Vietnamese-run Highland civil service, they were hardly neophytes when it came to knowing the massif. Hounded by the French for years, communists had often taken refuge there, like rebel kings before them. Moreover, the communist organization was, to my knowledge, the only modern political party before 1945 to have shown any real interest in Highland peoples and actually opened its doors to them. Catholic and Protestant missions were the only exceptions to this. By the Second World War, some of the most important leaders of the Communist Party were ethnic Thais from the far north, Hoang Van Thu, Hoang Dinh Yong, and Hoang Van Nan. Their multilingualism, local contacts, and knowledge of the highlands on both sides of the Sino-Vietnamese border made them priceless intermediaries for building the party. In 1941, for similar reasons, the communists recruited and promoted a Nung to the highest echelons of what became the People's Army of Vietnam. His name was Chu Van Tan. Between 1949 and 1954, Tan ran the administrative zone for all of northern Vietnam, demonstrating how people from a so-called ethnic minority could rise to the very highest levels of the Vietnamese army, state, and party. It is hard to find such a parallel in Bao Dai's Vietnam, and in any case, the French were opposed to precisely this type of national integration. Few non-Viet elite members served in the Nguyen court under the French. The communists would backtrack in the late 20th century, when relations with communist China melted down, Official racism raised its ugly head once more, and loyalties along the Sino-Vietnamese frontier blurred again. In 1979, the Viet majority of the Communist Party placed General Chu Van Thanh under house arrest, far from his family and friends along the Sino-Vietnamese border. The parallel with Nong Tri Cao must have crossed more than one historically informed mind. Lastly, Vietnamese communists working outside Indochina before 1941 were well-versed in internationalist communist forms of rule toward the ethnic minority question. Lest we forget, the Soviets and Chinese were also the inheritors of pre-existing multi-ethnic empires. During his long stay in Moscow in the 1930s, Ho would have had ample time to study this matter and the Federalist ideas communist theorists had devised to rule the USSR. The Indochinese Communist Party sent another ethnic Thai, Hoang Thu Hu, to Moscow to attend the Comintern Congress in 1935. When Ho Chi Minh left Moscow in 1938 to make his way to Vietnam, he traveled overland through the Central Asian borderlands of China before making his way into the multi-ethnic massif that the Yunnan and Guangxi provinces share with Indochina. When he set up the Viet Minh's base in the Pak Bo Caves of Cao Bang province, his success depended on non-Viet collaboration, and this would be the case until 1954. Like Pham Van Dong, Ho knew from personal experience that the highlands were not unpopulated regions. Little wonder flexibility characterized communist work among the highlanders. If local non-Viet elites pledged their loyalty to the Democratic Republic of Vietnam and refrained from aiding the enemy, the communists were content to operate through them to maintain security, obtain food, and recruit laborers and soldiers. Ho and his lieutenants did their best to immerse themselves in local cultures, organized literacy classes, and tried to learn at least some words in local languages. Ho dressed deliberately in local dress as a sign of communist sensitivity toward borderland peoples. Ho's men entered into contact with non-Viet leaders who had suffered under French rule, carefully exploiting, for example, the Deo family's mistreatment of the Hmong. The DRV avoided imposing onerous taxes, steered clear of cultural assimilation, respected local languages, helped develop French-initiated scripts for them, and, for the time being, delayed land reform and radical social revolution. The communists opened schools for upland children, introduced hygiene and medicines, and trained members of local elites for civil service and military positions, but always treated them as part of the wider Vietnamese family within a process focused on national integration. The Democratic Republic of Vietnam's shift to conventional warfare from 1950 onward led both the belligerents to rely ever more heavily on Thai, Hmong, and Nung peoples to supply highland battlefields with recruits, porters, intelligence, and food. The political autonomy the people there enjoyed up to this point began to disappear as the communists mobilized for war in the massifs, and the intensification of the war also brought more Americans into the highlands, although American Protestants had been in Vietnam since the 1920s. The Americans pushed the French hard to build up their special forces in the highlands, where they jutted into China's underbelly, convinced of the threat of a wider communist thrust into Southeast Asia, and now also themselves at war with the Chinese in Korea. As during the Second World War and again during the Vietnam War, the Americans wanted to use the geopolitical area of the massif to gather intelligence, harass the communists, create secure zones for the nationalists, and win over the hearts and minds of the uplands people whose lands ran deep into China. The CIA also supported Tibetan resistance to the Chinese at this time. Strapped for funds, the French acquiesced and operated two U.S.-backed special forces teams based in the highlands until 1954, the Commando Forces, Service Action, and the Airborne Mobile Commandos Groups, Groupement de Commandos Mixte Aéroportés. Deo Van Long joined the latter unit, and in so doing, further sealed his Thai Federation's alliance with the French and, indirectly, the Americans. The Vietnamese and their Chinese advisors went to great lengths to win over Thai support in this strategically vital northwestern part of Vietnam, where the conventional battles of the First Indochina War had culminated at the Dien Bien Phu. Moreover, it was the requirements of conventional war that saw the Vietnamese communists incorporate the Thai people into a Vietnamese party state born of this transition to total war. Dien Bien Phu was first a Thai town before this historic battle between the French and the DRV wiped it from the face of the earth. The upland peoples were anything but marginal to the march of Vietnamese history. States of War: The Makings and Unmakings of Highland Vietnam, 1954-75. Communist Autonomy in North Vietnam. Following the Geneva Conference agreements, the communist leadership rapidly dismantled what parts of the Thai Federation their armies had not already occupied in the run-up to the Dien Bien Phu. The People's Army of Vietnam and security services tracked down rebel leaders who had collaborated with the French, especially those of the Dao family, while many of the most important upland leaders had already evacuated the area along with the French. Dao Van Long was buried in France. Over 20,000 Nung, Thai, and Hmong emigrated to southern Vietnam. To administer the hundreds of thousands who remained, Vietnamese communists turned to Sino-Soviet federal ideas. In May 1955, for example, Democratic Republic of Vietnam created the Thai Hmong Autonomous Zone. In 1956, Hanoi expanded this officially into a larger Northern Vietnam Autonomous Zone, covering almost all of the Northern Massif, including over 1 million multi-ethnic people. While autonomous rule respected local languages, administration, religions, and cultures, the communists were in charge through their parallel party administration, Viet and loyal non-Viet cadres, their security services, and, if need be, their army. Like Ngo Dinh Diem in the south, Ho Chi Minh's government also promoted ethnic Viet immigration into the highlands and even implemented land reform policies which triggered suffering and violent opposition in many areas in the northern highlands. But unlike the situation in the Republic of Vietnam, the communist leadership imposed its rule free of international scrutiny. The Chinese were not going to criticize Hanoi, since Vietnamese communists were often applying their own Maoist methods. The Geneva ceasefire agreement prevented the DRV from controlling the Central Highlands, however. In 1954-5, the communists moved several thousand Viet and Highlander cadres to the DRV in the north of Vietnam. Things changed when it became clear that there would not be any elections in 1956, which might have united Vietnam by peaceful means, and civil war broke out once again among the Viet. By 1960, the Highlanders and the Central Massif found themselves in the crossfire as Hanoi infiltrated several thousand cadres back into the Central Highlands to rebuild bases and a parallel administration below the 17th parallel. Communist propaganda focused on Ngo Dinh Diem's assimilation policies in the highlands and promised autonomous rule to those who joined the righteous struggle for national unification. In 1960, the National Liberation Front came to life to serve as the Communist Party's new Viet Minh and shadow government in the south. The NLF's platform promised political autonomy to the Highlander peoples, declaring that all nationalities have the right to use and develop their own spoken and written languages and to preserve or change their customs and habits. Absent, of course, was any mention of Hanoi's land reform and less than autonomous rule in the Northern Massif. In 1961, the National Liberation Front organized a conference for the Highland peoples led by Ibe Aliao, a Radi leader and NLF member, which promised autonomy. As they had done during the First Indochina conflict, the communists opened new schools for children, promoted health care and hygiene, and trained Highlander bureaucrats and officers, sending many to the north for further training. The Democratic Republic of Vietnam badly needed these Highlanders and the cover of their lands to be able to run people and supplies along the Ho Chi Minh Trail into southern Indochina. Indeed, the Central Highlands played much the same role as had the northwestern Thai zones during the battles leading up to Dien Bien Phu. To ensure the functioning of this supply line and the Highland bases, at which more and more troops were arriving, Hanoi renewed its earlier training of ethnic Viet civil servants in Highland languages and customs before assigning them to the areas through which the trail, troops, and supplies flowed, including in eastern Laos and northeast Cambodia. These Viet groups of administrators often spoke flawless Radi, Banar, Khmu, Lao, and Khmer. They worked alongside Highlander elites to penetrate into villages to create safe zones and win over popular support. In 1969, DRV cadres working in the Highlands were astonished to find that one of theirs had gone native on them since 1946. At first we thought he was ethnic minority. He was thin, and his skin was dark. He wore his gray hair twisted into a bun like an onion atop his head. His teeth were filed, and he had a large hole pierced through his earlobe. He wore no shirt but only a loincloth. He carried a small bag on his back and a machete in his hand. I was surprised that he spoke fluent Vietnamese. I soon learned that he was originally from Thai Binh and had joined the march to the south in 1946. He had worked as a cadre organizing the masses during the resistance war against France. When peace was restored in 1954, he received orders to stay in the south and continue his activities undercover. After the Saigon administration promulgated the 1059 decree, he was hunted by this administration, and so he escaped to the Central Highlands. He filed his teeth and pierced his ears so he could look like the ethnic minority people, thereby avoiding enemy suspicion and also facilitating his organizational work. This fascinating account also reveals a step beyond the oath ceremony toward a new method for winning hearts and minds on the ground. Non-communist assimilation in the Republic of Vietnam. Ngo Dinh Diem was furious when he learned of the French decision to create the Thai Federation in 1948 and the Crown Domain for the Central Highlands in 1950. In 1955, first as Prime Minister and then as President of the Republic of Vietnam, Diem began dismantling the French Crown Domain. He replaced French commissioners with Viet provincial and district leaders who were subordinate to the central government in Saigon. He ran the long-established French colonial administrators out of the country, in particular Jean Cousseau. However, like his French predecessors, Diem solemnly performed the oath ceremony and Ban Mei Thuat. But things would be different and difficult for the Highlanders under this form of Vietnamese rule. For the first time since Minh Mang in the 1830s, they were now dealing with an ethnic Viet leader determined to assimilate them to a Vietnamese order. Indeed, Diem was convinced of the superiority of the Vietnamese civilizational order, of its advanced modernity, and of his right to place these people under central administrative control. On this note in particular, Diem took republicanism very seriously, discarding federal models in order to hold a multi-ethnic state together. The Ministry of the Interior took over Highland affairs. The central government administered Highland education, imposed Vietnamese as the common language, and threw out colonial textbooks in favor of a common Vietnamese curriculum. The Collège Sabatier became the Nguyen Du School. Just as importantly, Diem disbanded the remaining French special forces, which were still in charge of groups of Highlanders and thus outside Vietnamese control. Diem also saw a solution in the Central Highlands below the 17th parallel, to transfer there many of the 800,000 northern refugees who had arrived in the south since 1954. They included Catholics and Buddhists, as well as Hmong, Hmong, and Thai soldiers and their families. The idea was to relocate as many of them as possible to the Highlands' empty spaces. Diem promoted a land development program that allotted 5 hectares to each migrant family, provided them with tools, and gave them some seed. Many families moved there of their own volition. Others had no choice. By July 1959, 57 land development centers were in operation in the Central Highlands as 44,000 new Viet settlers cleared 11,000 hectares of land for rice, coffee, rubber, and cotton production. While many Vietnamese returned to the lowlands, others remained in the highlands, and from this point onward, the resumption of a centuries-old practice of Vietnamese colonial expansion was underway again with no French presence to check it. Moreover, American aid allowed the Vietnamese government to create new roads into the highlands, facilitating yet again the arrival of even more ethnic Vietnamese. Upland peoples did not remain idle, however. As the French withdrew from Vietnam and Diem asserted control, Highlander elites began discussing what to do. Leadership mainly came from among those who had studied in colonial schools and Christian missions, circulated as civil servants, teachers, and health workers under the French, or served in the special forces with the French during the First Indochina War. One of the Central Highlands' best-known Radi leaders, Y Thi Eben, studied at the Collège Sabatière as a teenager. Once he had finished there, he then worked as an accountant in the Darlac Provincial Health Service before serving as a medical assistant in the French Army. Opposed to Diem's assimilationist policies, in 1955, he and others joined forces to create the Liberation Front of the Highland Peoples, Front de Libération de Montagnard. They submitted a petition to President Diem, calling upon him to honor continued Highlander autonomy as set out by the provisions of the Crown Domain, to respect their customs and languages, and to protect their lands. While Diem did try to protect their lands from settlers and corrupt officials, his assimilationist policies and support of increased Viet immigration did not reassure. In 1958, as relations deteriorated further, Y Thi Eben joined Y Bam Inuel and Paul Nur, among others, to create the Bajarka movement. The name was an acronym for the Banar, Jarai, Radi, and Coho peoples. This movement was broadly based and united in its opposition to centralization along Viet lines. It demanded upland autonomy, an end to Viet immigration, and no more cultural assimilation. Diem responded by increasing police surveillance of the movement's activists, meting out heavy prison sentences to the rebels, redoubling his assimilationist policies, and dispatching more ethnic Viet officials to run the Central Massif. Increasingly, Diem regarded the individuals in the Bajarka movement as rebels, whereas this movement's leaders saw themselves as struggling righteously against a Vietnamese colonial thrust that would end their way of life, like the lowland Cham and Khmers before them. Tensions boiled over in the early 1960s as civil war intensified and different groups competed for the loyalty of the Highlanders. The communist shadow government, the National Liberation Front, promised autonomy to the Highlanders and brought their own members into its administration and armed forces. The Americans were back, too. And the use of special forces was part of John F. Kennedy's war on communist-backed guerrilla movements like the NLF. Starting in 1961, the CIA and a range of special forces began working with and recruiting Highland peoples to gather intelligence on the National Liberation Front, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, and the Ho Chi Minh Trail, connecting the two through the Central Highlands. In 1962, the CIA presided over its first Highlander schools and more, became involved in local affairs and politics. Fighting the communists necessitated it. Diem's heavy-handed policies, however, stimulated strong resistance among the Cham and Khmers and undermined American attempts to focus on the communists. Diem closed Khmer religious schools in the Delta and prohibited the use of Khmer. In 1960, angry Khmer Krom nationalists created the Liberation Front for Kampuchea Krom, Front de Libération de Kampuchea Krom, first led by Samuk Seng and then Chau Dara, with the express goal of recovering the territories the Vietnamese had taken from the Khmer Empire before the French arrived. Disgruntled Cham found a leader in Colonel Le Kosum, a Muslim Cham colonel from Cambodia who had presided over the creation of the Liberation Front for Champa, Front de Liberation de Champa. Like the Khmer Krom, he wanted Champa back. Supporting both were high-ranking Cambodian nationalists, including Lan Nol and Norodom Sihanouk, who had deeply resented the French decision in 1949-50 to unite Cochin China with the rest of Vietnam, instead of returning the lands the Vietnamese imperialists had taken from them. The Cambodians supported Cham and Kampuchea Krom separatists until 1975, hoping to return Cambodia's territorial size to its former glory. Things came to a head in the turmoil unleashed by Diem's assassination in late 1963 and the simultaneous decisions taken by Hanoi and Washington to go to war. In 1964, the Cham and Khmer Krom, with Phnom Penh leaders maneuvering in the background, saw the chance to advance their independence cause by creating the United Front for the Struggle of Oppressed Races, the Front Unifié de Lutte des Races Opprimées, better known as FULRO. This front was designed to combine the liberation aspirations and forces of the Khmer Krom, Cham, and Highlanders. The problem was that at the outset, the United Front for the Struggle of Oppressed Races leaders, Le Kosum and Savut, did not have the official support of the Bajarka movement, whose leaders hesitated between believing post-Diem Republican promises of Highlander reform and supporting him, or pursuing the armed line pushed by the United Front for the Struggle of Oppressed Races. For the latter to work, the Cambodian-based Cham and Khmer Krom badly needed those in the Bajarka movement's support, and that of the 1 million Highlanders of the Central Highlands they symbolically represented. In the end, the Bajarka movement split when, in mid-1964, Ibam and Nuol joined the United Front for the Struggle of Oppressed Races, bringing with him a few thousand armed supporters, while others tried to work with new reform-minded Viet leaders taking over in Saigon. Unsurprisingly, FULRO leaders used the Highlanders working in the American Special Forces to make their first attack, not on the Vietnamese communists, but rather on their fellow Viet soldiers. On the 20th of September 1964, as Lyndon Johnson prepared the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, the United Front for the Struggle of Oppressed Races fighters attacked the Vietnamese soldiers in a U.S. Special Forces camp in the Highlands, killing several but carefully refraining from harming any Americans. As a member of FULRO's armed forces told the American Marine he had temporarily disarmed, "This is our night! We're going to kill Vietnamese!" The United Front for the Struggle of Oppressed Races fighters raised their flag and called for the independence of the Highlands. Outraged, Saigon officials feared this revolt would spread and suspected the Americans might play the same divisive game as the French counterinsurgency specialists had during the First Indochina War. The Americans pushed both sides to back down and to keep their eye on the bigger picture, fighting the communists. Things quieted down for the time being, but the FULRO did not disappear, for there was no ignoring the impact on the Highlands and its people of centuries of colonial rule, both in its French and Vietnamese variants. Until 1975, the Republic of Vietnam leadership oscillated between the carrot, reforms, and the stick, repression. Many Highlanders welcomed reformism, but others, including Ibam Enuol and Le Kosum, retreated into Cambodia to continue harassing the Vietnamese from there. Well into the 1980s, the United Front for the Struggle of Oppressed Races hardcore members also rejected communist overtures to negotiate, opposed to all forms of Vietnamese imperialism. Of course, the communists had no intention of letting go of the land the Nguyen had colonized and made part of the present-day Vietnam before the French arrived. But FULRO's anti-colonial guerrilla war was but a smaller chapter in the maelstrom the Vietnam War unleashed on the Central Highlands. For if Johnson chose to start his war in the Gulf of Tonkin in 1964, a year later the armed forces of the DRV struck back in Pleiku and the Central Highlands, where the PAVN had ended the Indochina War in June of 1954. And if the First Indochina War had wreaked havoc across the Northern Massif, ending in the obliteration of the Thai town of Dien Bien Phu in 1954, the Second Indochina War would ravage the Central Highlands in ways no one could have imagined. Of the 80 million liters of herbicides the Americans dropped over Vietnam between 1962 and 1971, much, perhaps more than half of that amount, fell over the Central Highlands through which the Ho Chi Minh Trail ran. From the air, American B-52 bombings devastated the highlands, while Hanoi's Tet Offensive in 1968 ripped through Ban Mae Thuat. By 1972, the wars for Indochina, which had started in 1945, had displaced a mind-boggling 85% of all the Central Highland villages. In one instance, designed to create a free strike zone, the Americans forcibly relocated 10,000 Gerai people away from their villages. As one officer involved in this later recalled, "We set the houses on fire before the villagers were taken away to show them we meant business." Vietnamese communist troops engaged in equally brutal methods with similar results. And when the displaced Highlanders in Cham returned to claim their homes when the guns fell silent, they found many ethnic Viet there who refused to leave. Indeed, war and the arrival of American troops, many of them stationed in Highland areas, attracted ethnic Viet migrants. The Americans needed all sorts of Vietnamese entrepreneurs, such as suppliers, restaurant owners, and prostitutes, to help them house, feed, and entertain its forces. The number of Viet living in the highlands increased from around 50,000 in 1954 to 450,000 two decades later. But the non-Vietnamese paid a high price during the Vietnam War. An estimated 200,000 Highlanders are thought to have perished during the war. The overwhelming majority of them were civilians. Again, the non-Viet people were not on the margins of modern Vietnamese history, but right in the middle of it. They always had been. Conclusion. Authoritarianism, republicanism, and political change. In 2005, as an expanding economy pulled Vietnam from the depths of poverty, the communist authorities of the Socialist Republic of Vietnam allowed Hoang Minh Chinh to travel to the United States for medical treatment. Chinh had joined the Indochinese Communist Party in the 1930s and distinguished himself as a commando during the First Indochina War before becoming one of the country's leading experts in Marxist theory. He had worked closely with the leadership in tailoring communism to the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. Chinh also landed himself in hot water when, in 1963, he had questioned the Politburo's ideological dogmatism and decision to go to war. Having studied in Moscow in the late 1950s as de-Stalinization spread across the communist world, he returned home to argue with the leadership that socialism could best be attained through peaceful evolution. But for those in Hanoi who wanted to return to war and gain Mao's support for it, Hoang Minh Chinh's views made him a revisionist. He was in and out of prison until the 1980s, when a second wave of communist reformism led by the Soviet Union's Mikhail Gorbachev released him from his semi-criminal revisionist status and seemed to vindicate him. It certainly emboldened him. As Gorbachev allowed homegrown democracies to replace dictatorships of the proletariat in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, Chinh urged the Vietnamese communists to do the same. This was the message he carried with him to the United States in 2005. In interviews, speeches, and meetings, he called for the introduction of the rule of law, freedom of speech and religion, liberty of the press, free elections, and multi-party politics. In a comparison designed to remind communist leaders that they were on the wrong side of history, Hoang Minh Chinh praised the 19th century German socialists who, despite Marx's rebuke of their revisionist moderation, had pushed through a groundbreaking political program at Gotha in 1875, one of the pillars on which modern social democracy stands. Until his death in 2008, Chin championed the creation of just such a social democratic state working within the framework of a capitalist economy. Of course, Vietnamese communists saw things differently. Even though they had authorized a capitalist economy to flourish, Lenin's single-party state still suited them just fine for ruling. Political change has certainly occurred with the introduction of a market economy, and with it, the opening of the country to the non-communist world, its international organizations, rules, capital flows, and interactions with civil society. However, today's communist leaders have nevertheless carefully defined political change in reformist terms, so as to co-opt those who would do away with the vanguard role of the party. What all this means for the country's political future is anybody's guess, but if the past is any guide to this, the leadership can count on Vietnamese Republicans to continue opposing authoritarian rule, while Vietnamese citizens will push for more political change in their everyday lives. Maintaining communist legitimacy in a post-communist world. In an economy where the Vietnamese Communist Party pushes capitalism as its policy and has abandoned a centrally planned economy in favor of one allowing private entrepreneurship, its leaders have had to shift their ideological raison d'etre from defending class struggle and proletarian internationalism to promoting economic prosperity and inclusive nationalism for all social groups. Through school textbooks, official histories, museums, billboards, and the media, the party now highlights its historic role as the defender of national independence against the invading French, Japanese, Americans, and Chinese. Schoolchildren learn how the party led the August Revolution to victory in 1945, defeated the French colonizers at Dien Bien Phu a decade later, and united the entire country against all odds in 1975. This, in turn, is presented as the latest chapter in an ancient tradition of resistance reaching back 2,000 years. The message is clear. The communists are legitimate because, like their ancestors, they are the nation's defenders. Meanwhile, party chroniclers carefully prune problematic events from the narrative. Close collaboration with Mao's China into the 1960s, for example, fits badly with the country's present problems dealing with their northern neighbor in the South China Sea. Ho Chi Minh may have created the Indochinese Communist Party in 1930, but his role in spreading communism to Thailand, Malaysia, Cambodia, and Laos is not what authorities want to emphasize today in their role as a member of the Common Market-Minded Association of Southeast Asian Nations. And when a special exhibition on the land reform campaigns of the 1950s opened in Hanoi in September 2014, authorities closed it within days as young people gasped at the class violence the party had unleashed against its own people, and angry farmers used the occasion to vent their anger about current land disputes. Party historians have been particularly careful to shield Ho Chi Minh from accusations of any wrongdoing in the carrying out of such grandiose projects designed to remake society in the communist mold. To suggest that the country's president was responsible for assaults on his own people during the land reform programs weakens the leadership's ability to use its great leader to weave nationalism and communism into a powerful source of legitimation. Indeed, the potential for Ho's life and work to define communist rule in nationalist terms was such that when he died in 1969, his disciples refused to honor the president's request that he be cremated and have his ashes scattered across the country. Instead, his followers embalmed him and placed his body on display in a massive mausoleum in downtown Hanoi,